who was embodying the scapegoat in a very particular way, and that the Gospels were showing that because all other myths, according to Girard anyway, they have the scapegoat in there, but it's not identified as a scapegoat because the myths identify the sacrifice as guilty.
Sure, right.
But the Gospels identify and insist on Jesus' innocence, right, and beyond. I mean, his ultimate innocence. Therefore, they're exposing the scapegoat mechanism that's inside, embedded inside all myths. Therefore, they're a decoder or a disruptor or an invalidator, whatever you want to call that, of all previous myths, which perpetuate the idea of the violent sacred and the sacredness of violence and the need for sacrifice, of the physical sacrifice. Jesus' sacrifice, according to Girard, was the true sacrifice of giving up everything for God, and that means imitating only God, and that means actually turning away from Satan, which is mimetic desire.
Sure. In a sense, though, it seems, you know, if you think of the martyrs, so they were, you know, in a way just copycats or...
of each other. well, except, I mean...
So they're just reinforcing that same idea, you know, of...
Well, it depends. I mean, yeah. Girard would say that the prophets before Jesus were, I don't know if he would say they were equal to Jesus, because he was a Christian, so he believed that Jesus was God, but it's a bit unclear and it's a bit unsatisfying about Girard is that he doesn't extend his very rigorous intellectual inquiry to the question of Christ and God, and he just kind of sort of uses a band-aid to kind of hold the whole thing together, I feel, but... maybe he didn't have time to really look into that. What does that mean? You know, what does Christ, as a way of being, mean? With the way that he examines and unpacks what Satan means as a way of being, mimetic rivalry, and the mechanism that demands a scapegoat is this satanic thing that within all of us. So what's the corresponding equivalent of the Christ thing, which is within all of us, which entails letting go of the need to compete, to imitate other men, or other people, to have power in the world. I don't know. I mean, I'm having to improvise now because I say I don't think he did unpack it, but his idea is that mimetic desire in itself isn't bad. It's what you imitate. So the satanic aspect of mimetic desire is rivalry. It's human rivalry. It's competitive, and it demands a scapegoat in order for the group not to destroy itself because of that rivalry. So it basically perpetuates violence, and so I say Satan is the father of lies, and because the lie is that violence the lie is that culture is founded on anything but murder. The lie is that the murder is not a murder, that it's a sacrifice. Right. That's the satanic lie. The father's the Satan of, that Satan is the father of. Freudian slip there. And so then the positive mimetic desire is to turn away from all of those models and model oneself only on God. But he doesn't answer, I mean, how do you model yourself on God?
Right.
Like, what is God?
Yeah.
Unless you believe in it, and then you say, oh, well, God is Christ. Christ was the man who modeled God, so we model ourselves on Christ. That means the Gospels. And that's more or less what Girard ends up saying, is that the Gospels are it. So he might even be like, you're priest who says don't read Thomas. I don't know, I can't believe he would have been that hardline, but he is presenting the Gospels as this truly sacred text, and the idea of Christ as presented in the Gospels as not just true but necessary. And there I can't follow him, even though I also have a relationship with something that I have called Christ and feel that that is very meaningful and that's where it's at. But isn't that just the soul? I mean, just isn't God slash Christ words that we put on the psyche, as in our own totality? If the psyche is the totality, this is where we get off the map, and why people end up believing in beings from Arcturus, right, or Christ, or whatever it is, because if you can't really create a frame of reference around, and as you said, there's no ritual, a framework of ritual for enlightenment, then you just go to the framework of rituals that do exist, because you don't want to go out there without a net. You don't want to go out in the wild without a net.
Yeah. I'd agree with you, though, and that's what I've come to after everything, is, you know, that an idea of an authentic self is all, or soul, whatever you want to call it, is all you can try to understand, you know, and even that in itself is...
Well, experience, yeah. I think that's also what I'm saying, is we can't understand it except by experiencing it, and we don't know even then that we will understand it.
Right.
By experiencing it, we may just experience it and never understand it.
Yeah, I mean, we've spent a lifetime, you know, building up defenses, or, you know, through conditioning or our own false models or whatever. So I think the process is in just, you know, deconstruction to see what's left, what's, you know, what, if any, foundation remains.
It seems like that, yeah. And the ground is accepting that there is no ground.
Yeah, and I like your emphasis on the body. I think that's become more and more true in my life. In most of my pursuits, I think we're fantasy based. You know, I think many are. And that's the new, you know, agenda, if you want to call it that, is to leave the body.
The new agenda?
Yeah.
It's not really new,
right?
Is it?
No.
The new old.
Right.
Well, it's interesting that we're talking about Christianity so much. I've been reading about it with Gerard, because there's been some very interesting comments, and not... Well, I think they've been at the blog too, but in response to the Prisoner of Infinity material, which I'm, you know, redistributing, and I've been doing it through disinfo.com as well, and somebody there, I think there's also been comments at the blog about this, about the overlap with the idea of trauma as a means to enlightenment, and child abuse, and all of the, you know, that whole can of worms that opens up when you start looking at that with Christian tradition, and also the de-eroticization of spirituality, and the rejection of the body, of course, is fundamentally Christian. Or is that, maybe that's not correct to say, but it's, if it's not, then it was inserted into Christianity very early on.
Yeah, it seems so.
And so, I think there's a lot there. Well, somebody was, at Disinfo, was making some very interesting observations about the Whitley Strieber connection to the Sisters of Mercy, right? Because that's where he traced his early experiences with the visitors. Well, first of all, to the Nazi CIA, MKUltra abuse that he suffered, but, he only includes the visitors there in terms of that they rescued him from that, and that trauma fractured his psyche, or broke his mirror of expectation, as he puts it, and allowed him to access the realm in which the visitors exist. But as far as his first remembered interactions with the visitors, he traces it back to the secret school, as he called it, and these nuns called the Sisters of Mercy, who were actually visitors. I mean, it's, as in so much of Strieber's stuff, it's not clear, like, were they nuns and visitors, or, you know, did he think they were nuns? It's not really clear how it was that he remembered them as nuns at the time, or experienced them at the time as nuns, but then later realized that they'd been visitors, or non-human beings. But anyway, Strieber was a Catholic, or is a Catholic, I should say, because he's never And what this person points out is, I'm trying to actually find the quote because it would be easier. There it is. He says, it hadn't occurred to me to look at international angle on the Roman Catholic state collusion in child abuse that happened in Ireland, but it's easy to forget that the church is an international organization. Nuns and the Marian cults especially are a pretty deep rabbit hole. They're all pretty gone on apparitions, visitations, direct communication with the Virgin Mary, flagellation, contrition and penitence. As far as I understand it, they believe quite firmly in the purification of themselves through mortification of the body. The idea is that if you punish your body sufficiently, you reach a state of innocence in which you're granted a transcendental vision experience. So if they routinely use things like starvation and physical pain to induce these states in themselves, would they balk at doing it to others? Also, their worldview and logic. If children are already innocent, they don't need as much punishment to cross over. And 8 of the 10 acknowledged apparitions of Mary were to children. Of course, they included UFOs, those apparitions. Finally, they may have viewed this practice as redemptive for the children, purifying them of their sinful entrance into the world. So and then he says, as for the whole national security shutdown, what if the alphabets got wind of the transcendental nuns, Sisters of Mercy, who bought, sold, and used children to the finders, for example, and saw an interesting asset or avenue of investigation in whatever program followed on? So what he's suggesting is something I had never considered, really, is an overlap there between Christian, specifically Catholic, groups, organizations, refuges for children, etc., and MKUltra.
That makes sense to me. I mean, given their history with, child abuse, that I think,
Yeah, and that there's an underlying philosophy, that unites them.
I think body shame is key, especially to, the more extreme sects of Christianity, especially Catholic. It wasn't so big with me, but I actually was drawn to that. My church was evangelical, which is pretty tame, but I was actually very interested in fasting, not necessarily self-flagellation, but in the idea that the body is needs to be overcome, kind of its cravings and desires are all sinful and
I still wrestle with that. Like every day I kind of think I'm aware of, and often in my dreams, because I dream about food, for example, obviously dream about sex, and I'm aware of it not in a Christian sense, although I'm sure it's been incepted through those memes, but just like, well, when I die, if I have these attachments, or these addictions, or whatever word I use for them, it might be a problem. So I'm constantly sort of aware of how much I take refuge in physical pleasure on a day-to-day basis, and that I maybe need to address it.
Well, it seems religion in particular is a very black and white sort of one or the other mentality where the body is evil, the soul is pure. And I think liminality is kind of the middle path. It's not buying into either one and maybe exploring and experiencing, hedonism and asceticism, I think, or a balance at least.
Well, yeah, cancelling, yeah. I mean, that's back to the sort of alcohol dry drunk thing, is putting meaning where there's no need to assign meaning. So the body is neither pure or impure. I mean, even the idea of purity, where does that come from? And what all it refers to is foreign elements.
It's very
So,
Christian too. The pre-fall,
yeah.
Adam, Eve.
Right. Yeah, it predisposes. It's also Platonic because it pre not predisposes, but presupposes a this perfect realm, the Pleroma and the Gnostic thing. This perfect realm of non-manifestation. Well, okay, fine, but if it's not manifest, well, it's not there anyway. It's not, right? So everything that exists by that in that context is impure. That would even include the soul if we're going to give it some kind of discrete existence separate from the totality. But then if you pull far enough back, even in the physical realm, well, everything is interconnected. If the whole universe is interconnected physically, how can anything impure exist in the universe? It would have to come from outside the universe.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I think it's an interesting contrast, with individuals who underwent trauma at an early age, where that is supposed to be a place from purity. So, are they that much more affected by abuse because, that it is an unsoiled state?
Children. Well, I don't think that relates to the purity, but to the, I mean, it can be if it's misrepresented, but correctly presented, I think it relates to the openness and the vulnerability, in which we then assign a sort of value judgment of purity versus impurity.
Yeah.
As opposed to, well, openness. I mean, purity and impurity isn't really a spectrum. Like, essentially, if you have the idea of pure and impurity, if you introduce a so-called impure element into a pure substance, it's become impure. That's it, right?
Yeah.
Game over. So the smallest sin and you're damned.
Right.
That's how it is. Whereas open and closed or whatever terms we're going to use for that with children versus adults, it's clearly a spectrum.
Right.
So how, yeah, and how deeply we're impacted by something and the effect it has in terms of creating disharmony in the body, which then prevents the soul from dwelling in the body by either pushing it out or preventing it from fully coming in, if it was still trying to come in, whichever, or both. Or, and again, we're in this area where we don't really understand enough to talk about it. But that seems to me what gets mistakenly interpreted as purity, impurity, and all these religious and moral value judgments around whether or not the soul is fully aligned with the body, and therefore, and because, whatever, the body is working in harmony, like it's not all blocked up with trauma and poisons and other people's stuff that got put into us, which I think is the closest we have to a real impurity as well. If you're a child and an adult sexually violates you physically and psychically, of course, if it's physical, it's going to be psychic, but it can also be psychic and non-physical. Hence, we've got this very liminal realm that's particularly obvious with ritual abuse things, where did it happen? Did it not? Well, sometimes maybe it wasn't physical, but the fantasy was so strong that the child picked it up and got embedded with fantasy. But in any event, particularly if it's physical, I don't think there can be any doubt that the child is having stuff implanted in its body psyche system that doesn't belong there. And that's an impurity in terms of the us existing as individuals. Which, although that may be an illusion at the deepest, highest level, it's definitely not an illusion in terms of being part of our development as consciousness in this realm, is that we're supposed to individuate, and we can't individuate if our system is all jammed up with stuff from other systems.
Yeah.
Stuff on our hard drive that's not supposed to be there. We can't. The hard drive's not running because it's all jammed up.
And with the Christian model in particular, it seems like punishment is almost a way of purifying it,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's self-flagellation or fasting, and that whole model of sinning and then forgiveness, that then, once you ask for forgiveness, that's your blank slate, you're pure again, and it's just this cyclical model of sinning and asking for forgiveness, that I think which the is, idea of asking for forgiveness almost in itself encourages, that the person will sin again. I know that was true in my own life.
What ensures that a person will sin again?
That they know that they can ask for forgiveness.
It's funny, because I was thinking for the first time that it ought to be the opposite. If you know that any sin you commit can be forgiven, it ought to prevent that self-punishing, self-judgment part of oneself from being so powerful, which would then prevent the sinning.
Right.
I mean, that seems to be the theory behind it. It seems to be a sort of oversimplification, over-literalization of the Girardian thing, or an externalization of the Girardian thing, which is that you don't have to participate in mimetic rivalry.
Right.
You can just turn away. You can just turn the other cheek. So it's the priest forgiving us is supposed to represent Christ, which is supposed to represent a part of ourselves, which can let go of anything that happens, or of anything that we do. We don't have to identify with the trauma, with the abuse, or with our own reactions to it, because that, you know, the part that does identify is the internal accuser, Satan, that perpetuates the abuse, as we're talking about with James Quigley the last time. Like, if our desires are forbidden to us, then we feel, as soon as our desire arises, we start to persecute ourselves for them, and then the desires themselves become persecutory. So sexual desire, sexual expression becomes violent, becomes destructive.
Yeah, I think you'd brought that idea up before, you know, that just the fact that there is this idea of hell and Satan and extremely dark aspects to Christianity that, you know, through kind of a psychological reversal, the person ends up, you know, being satanic and enacting out, you know, the opposite. And that's definitely true with priests and, you know, and the rampant abuse there.
And the social engineers who seem to be trying to push us to the next level of evolution, and Whitley's aliens also, of course, there's higher level abuse.
Right. I think, you know, that's why I first left the church, is because I felt it was hijacked, and I met someone later who does claim to be a Christian, but he views, you know, most modern forms of Christianity as Satanism, and I can't disagree with him. I think,
well, except Satanism is Christianity, so
right, because <Yeah. laughs> it reinforces, I mean, yeah, the opposites, and yeah.
Dark, cold world out there. There's a time to live and a time for a man to die. There are places for dead men in the earth and the sky. Don't you venture too far now, 'cause you can't come back from the place where the good guys always dress in black. When you go to the old saloon, dead south end, gonna find you a man there wants to be your friend. If you dare to deny his wish, you'll be dead by dawn. So give him a drink and a smile and then move right on. Rednecks with white faces, don't go putting on down. Fingers.
it's all the externalization. I only feel I'm getting to the ground when I'm beginning to understand all of this huge picture outside of ourselves that's so overwhelming. When I start to identify in terms that I can experience directly that relate to my own internal psychological mechanisms.
Right. Yeah.
Then I start to feel that I'm finding the ground.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a feeling of immense relief. I finally got this from reading Girard, and it's interesting because I got this Girard reader, which I got for my wife's birthday years ago, and she hasn't read it yet, and I picked it up like 2 years ago or less and started to read it, and I just put it down. I said, there's no way I can read this. This is just impossible. It's just so difficult. But I've been reading it now, and I'm reading it just for pleasure. It's just, I find it so easy, and I don't know what changed. I mean, I must have internalized an understanding, because it doesn't seem particularly difficult now. And as I say, beyond that, there's a feeling of real lightness, of lightening, when somebody is describing something that seems beyond comprehension at an intellectual level, in terms not that they're so simple, but that are somehow, that just make sense.
Yeah.
And that apply to one's own experience. It's like something massive gets reduced to something very, very small, but it's still massive, right? So the scapegoat mechanism, mimetic desire, is massive because it's throughout the whole planet, and it's, you know, creating all of these unbelievable webs of deception and abuse that we are fascinated by and feel overwhelmed ever understanding. It's massive in that regard, but it's this tiny, tiny phenomena, this psychological, physiological even. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you'd call it. I mean, you could call it a mechanism, but it's actually part of the machinery itself. It's like a law of the psyche.
Yeah.
So it's a fundamental principle of existence. So it's tiny, you know. It's like like in mathematics, it's really infinitesimal, right? Because it doesn't have a scale. It's not really part of this world. It's part of our DNA. So it's a submolecular particle, and so it has massive simplicity to it, but not intellectually. I mean, if you try and figuring it out intellectually, it just seems impossible. But when you actually see it, it's just like, oh, it's just, it was always there. It's been running our hard drive since the beginning of existence. So of course we know it. We know it intimately. Satan and Christ, we know them both intimately because they're functions within the psyche.
Yeah, almost like they're part of the reptilian brain.
Well, the Satan would be the reptilian, yeah. So then that leaves, there's still this question of, you know, what is Christ?
Yeah.
Where do we locate that? Because it seems to me that if we're going to have a working experience of the relationship between the soul and the body and understand the soul through embodying it, then there must be a correspondence of everything that exists as the soul must correspond with the body in some way. So then Christ should also be localizable, that's the word,
yeah.
Locatable, not exactly in the body. I mean, it's not like, I mean, that's because that's what the Hadron maniacs are trying to do, right? They're actually trying to find the thing physically, but
right.
but to connect to it through the body in some way and say, oh, there it is. Okay, that's, and I guess I, now I'm saying that I do have this experience. The experience is what Guy was describing as joy in a recent podcast, and what Dave Ashana calls the transmission. There's a signal in the body that is, that can be located and can be experienced, and that is what's been given, you know, the holy names have been assigned to it.
Yeah, I've had that experience myself, and, you know, I think it is a personal thing, or that's how I've come to view it. You know, the myth itself is, you know, God came down into the body of Christ, and, you know, to bring it to a more personal level, it's our soul coming down into our body, And, you know, I think anyone has that ability. It's just, you know, people get carried away with the whole messianic complex. Like, you know, we all feel that we found it sometimes, but then we get carried away with telling everyone.
Right.
And, you know, that whole mess. So, and I find I usually experience it, and I know what you're talking about when you read something and it just resonates. And it's when the writer is feeling something when they're writing it, and the reader picks up on that, and I don't know, there's a union that occurs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah. So that's, there was something in there about the communion of saints, or because there's a correspondence with Christ. I mean, Christ's body is humanity, or that whole Christian idea.
Right.
I think there's a that's somehow a balancing to the, because when you, if and as the psyche lands in the body, there is a corresponding experience, I can imagine, based on my psychedelic distortions of this experience and my dreams. There's an experience of being the totality, of becoming God, as in the whole of consciousness is, because it's a microcosm. You know, the soul is connected to the whole system of consciousness of the universe, and so one's own personal connection to the soul is one's connection to God, and one's becoming unified with God, to use the word I never use, but yeah. We're talking in the Christian lingo now. Sure. And so then there is an experience there of, oh my God, I am God, I am everything. And then it's, oh, I'm the one, fantastic, fuck me, I'm going to write a book, I'm going to be, you know, I'll put on the black suit, I'll put on everything. The ego, if it happens prematurely, and it's not the soul landing, then it's something else, but whatever, if we access at least a simulation of that full integration experience, and the ego mind is still intact, and it gets hold of it, and it spins in, and it creates this other thing, which is, yes, I'm the one and you're not, I'm God and no one else is. And so the counter to that is that we can only really fully land in our body and become fully harmonized with the collective consciousness of God / the universe through connecting to others, through that I'm not going to use communion because that's extremist thing, and it's Catholic, but the communitas, that's the liminalist term, of the tribe.
Right.
Without the scapegoat mechanism, like a tribe without a scapegoat, the thing that this has never happened, maybe it never does happen, but there's a level at which it can happen where we experience ourselves as becoming whole and individuated and one, soul and body united, which I think corresponds with experiencing ourselves as part of a collective of souls.
Yeah, and I struggle with that. But I know what you're saying, and I do believe that, and I feel like my own path has more and more taken me into myself, and in a way I've kind of taken an isolationist stance. I think a lot of it has to do with the pain I went through in breaking up with my girlfriend. I think I just, you know, I literally moved away to a different town and lived off grid in a cabin in the middle of the woods, you know, and went about my own process of individuation, but I did it almost stubbornly, you know, almost, yeah, I viewed society as this just sickness that I didn't want to participate in, and I think in a way it was stubborn and it was selfish, kind of.
Well, it sounds like what happened for me when I was much younger than you, I guess. I was 24 when I had massive emotional breakup and went off to Morocco with no money, and it was a retreat. It was a necessary retreat from everything.
Yeah, my trip was very similar. I left about half a year later to India. But it was like I had to leave everything. You know, that was the intention of it. It wasn't that I was going there to find something, though I did in the earthquake. But yeah, I think I know what you mean. I feel not. I don't want to say a calling because then it's you know, messianic again. But there is a need to communicate. You know. Thoughts, feelings, soul expressions, whatever. And that's the only way that I think they're validated. Mm-hmm. And it's just working on at least being truer in that process.
Yeah, and the validation doesn't come from the other person. It doesn't come from the other person, but it's as though I think that if we're able to express something and have it fully received by the other person, that's the validation. So they wouldn't have to actually echo it in any way.
Right.
Or agree with it or affirm it. Yeah. But just knowing and feeling like you're saying about reading a book and you resonate with where that person's at. That's what made me think of this to begin with. We feel it when we're received.
Right.
At a very deep level. And then we know that we're heard and we can fully hear ourselves and then it's gone, you know, whatever the thing that we were trying to locate in ourselves has been located, so then the need to locate it is gone and then we move on to the next part. I think that's how we become fully lit up or activated is by being heard in all of our different expressions until there is no need to isolate and hide that part of us that we fear is destructive, that's going to ruin everything, and eventually there's nowhere for the Satan thing to hide either. That's and then there's no need for it. There's no need for the fight or flight because there's nothing to fight and there's nothing to fly from.
Yeah.
I think that's the human experience. I was going to say goal, but then it's the goal-oriented thing is reptilian too, I think. Yeah. So, but that is the fundamental human experience, is that we're not here to survive.
Right, yeah. Yeah. As an artist, I think artists know this intuitively, just that they have to get something out. You know, it's usually an emotional process, but hopefully not one at the end. You know, hopefully I think emotions are just kind of can be messy.
They're definitely messy, yeah. But you wouldn't want art that didn't have emotions.
I agree.
You'd have Kubrick then.
Yeah. That's true. I've always been more of a listener though, you know, so this is new for me. Even with my art, I've never pushed it or tried to, I don't know. I don't know what it is, whether it's social anxiety or a fear of recognition, which is even stranger. And, but yeah, there still is this, you know, gut need to get it out at least. But what happens with me is, you know, I record music and then I record it and, you know, I'm absolved of whatever the emotion was and then I'm done with it. It's like, I don't like it afterwards because I've already integrated whatever that feeling was. So pushing it or getting it out there seems like, you know, carrying along old baggage or something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's.
So it's like art in the present is really what.
So, but then that's you communicating with yourself,
right?
Which is certainly it wouldn't be art, to use the word I try not to use, without that. But I don't think that I'm not sure if it's art. If it's only that, either.
Right.
I mean, that's a stupid word, but we're talking about communication. So for me, art's a stupid word because it's self-expression. That's all it is, right? But it's not all it is because you can self-express alone at home.
Right.
And that can serve this function that you're describing of actually discovering something in yourself and getting it out and seeing it and letting go of it, however that works, catharsis and all that stuff. But it's not communication. So I'd say what we call art is self-expression plus communication. And and that's what I'm interested in. I mean, I'm obviously I'm interested in self-expression. You're dead if you're not, and you die if you don't. But and I think that's the only way the soul lands is through expressing,
right?
Through the body. But I'm also a communicator, as you know. That's why we're talking. I've got this. I'm just going to use the word ministry again. That's messianic. I used to use that term a lot. But anyway, I got this platform that I communicate from, and it means something to me to reach people to whom it means something to be reached. There's definitely meaning in that. It, on this temporal plane, like as a daily thing, it's one of the most meaningful things in my life. And that presumably is because a big part of my embodiment is not just self-expression, and not just one-to-one, although I do like one-to-ones, and a lot of what I do does begin as a one-to-one like this, but to communicate to the tribe, to use that term again, to a collective, not the collective, certainly not to everyone. There's something to me at least, and I won't say it's the same for you, and it's certainly not the same for everyone, is when rubber meets road. And so, right, this Prisoner Infinity is interesting in this context, because I did it 2 years ago, almost 3 years ago now, and so part of me was thinking, why on earth am I blogging this again? This is, I'm going to be get known as like the guy, the Horsley who flogs the dead horse, you know, the Strieber horse. He can't let go. Not that I necessarily care what other people think, but I was starting to think that. I just got deja vu then. Maybe I'm just flogging the dead Whitley here. Why do I want to put this stuff out again? But actually, it's been really satisfying. It really did need reworking, adding the images, getting new readers. It's communicating. Because finding it and exploring it and expressing it was a massive thing. And it never felt like I'd completely communicated it. So this is like the completion of that, I hope.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, that for me is rubber meeting road. It's like I don't think it's just needing validation. I think it's something else. It's just needing to communicate at the level that the material requires to validate itself, like that thing of saying, when you know that you've been heard. Well, I didn't feel heard with Crucial Fictions 2 years ago. Like I knew this material was explosive when I put it out then. It wasn't like I was expecting any massive kind of recognition, but I really felt unheard by just a few readers. And so, I just think the quantity and quality of the material required a certain level of reception, let's say. The transmission requires a reception.
Right.
In order for it to be, like you were saying, that you can let go and it's done. I think for me, yeah, there's some stuff I do, I can do it alone and that's it, and then I forget about it. There's other stuff, I guess it comes from a deeper place.
Yeah.
Occult Yorkshire was another example, Seen Not Seen. I don't feel that Seen Not Seen has been received, by the way, so that's lingering. But yeah, certain stuff it requires, like I've got to get myself fully behind it, full body behind it, and then, boom, then I can fire the arrow, and then, okay, then it's done.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, with material like this, it takes time for the, you know, the ripple to reach the right people, I think. And, you know, it seems especially relevant now. I don't know if you've caught the first two episodes of the new X-Files series.
I watched the first one with my wife, and it was so appalled by the quality of it that we're probably not going to carry on watching. But I was definitely interested in the content.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's just funny after just going over your stuff that's the basic premise for this little reboot. You know, is to say that it's not an alien conspiracy; it's a human conspiracy. You know,
yeah.
I mean, the whole thing's been engineered, and I don't know, it's just funny.
Yeah, I certainly had the same thought. Interesting time, yeah, almost really. to the day.
And I don't know, it's been personally interesting for me going over all my experiences again. You know, I think when I read anything, that's what I do, and I don't think I'd fully understood, you know, a lot of those things. And
I first heard from you when you read Seen and Not Seen,
right?
But had you read other stuff before that?
Yeah, I read Lucid View first a long time ago. I guess that might have been 2009 or 10, and then that really hit me. I really at the time was you know, into conspiracy literature, and I really liked your take that paranoia was a form of awareness, because that's how I felt when I was you know, learning about all this. Is I didn't feel like that classic, you know, stereotype of anxiety ridden and, you know, socially awkward, although I probably was individual. To me, it was a form of awareness reading this stuff. And just deepening the picture, really, within myself. And then I read Homo Sapiens right after that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then followed your old blog a little bit, but I guess I lost touch before the stormy weather. Although I've revisited a lot of that. And then, yes, I was excited, Seen and Not Seen, I think I told you, because of my brother. Right. And his experiences in Hollywood, and what I think media in general has meant for him is just, you know, generated fantasy of, you know. Well, just that, you know, we take this media like so seriously, and it it forms a model, and we
it's because I think I've seen and not seen as being an entirely different genre or entirely different type of book, certainly the Lucid View, but most of the other material I do, because it seems to be ostensibly about movies and pop culture, so it has a much more mainstream kind of sheen to it, even if it didn't have a mainstream appeal. But in fact, of course, it's all part of the same inquiry. And I think that's one of the things I touched on with Prisoner Infinity. I think it's in the introduction, which I didn't blog. Of how we underestimate just how much our interpretations, our perceptions are shaped by mass media as children, and how much that's informed the whole of ufology.
Yeah.
Like, it's really acknowledged, but that's it. It's acknowledged, and then there's kind of, I mean, for example, the idea that the UFO phenomenon tends to appear in fiction before there's actual accounts of it.
Right. Yeah, especially like going way back with the Amazing Stories.
So any given sort of element that eventually becomes a staple element in ufology, if you trace it back, the first appearance of it is in a work of fiction. So that's been written about, I don't know if it's John Keel, Jack Valley, but certainly it is part of what ufology acknowledges, but somehow it doesn't take it, or certainly doesn't take it far enough, but it's like it doesn't really take it any further. It's some, I think, and this is another thing with Kripal that I feel there's something off there, because I think it just falls back on, oh well, this is because this is a phenomenon that's emerging from some other dimension, and therefore yes, it can manifest through our fiction just as it's manifesting in the skies, right? The imaginal interpretation, which although there's truth in that, it's kind of, it's a good way to I'm having a brain block, brain hemorrhage, I can't think of the word, but it's a good way to avoid or just make redundant any inquiry into social engineering and conscious agendas. Which again, there's just so much more ground in them. Like I was watching the X-Files the other night, they came up, Lucifer, they were plugging Lucifer, because it was going to be showing right after the
Yes,
X-Files,
I
right?
noticed that.
Right. I read those comic books, by the way. I'm not going to watch the TV show because I saw the trailer and it looked terrible. But and needless to say, I was big into comic books, and my identification with Lucifer was compounded by them. If any, I don't think it was altered much by them. But anyway, it was just a big part of my mythology, the Lucifer thing. So of course, I read the comic books. But it occurred to me anyway that, oh God, so the Sinkheads and I would be writing about this. It's the X-Files and Lucifer back to back, and you can imagine how you can extrapolate from all that, all kinds of social engineering things, although Sinkheads don't necessarily take it to social engineering, but whatever, the prescriptive programming, and even to the extent that they do, it's all about this occult symbolism and how they're bringing about shifts in consciousness and stargates and all the rest of it. But at this point, it's not only easy to imagine, but I would say foolish to leave out that the TV production companies themselves, even at the low levels, must be aware of all these different researchers who are reading all this stuff into it and be playing into that now. And they say, oh, let's put Lucifer after the X-Files because all those YouTube nuts will freak out and blah, 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 you know. So it's capitalism. I mean, so much of it is capitalism, and not that it's just about money. It isn't. It's about keeping the whole system moving. So it's more than money, it's power and control. But money is a big part of it, and selling to us the products and priming us so we will buy the future products. And occultism is advertising. It's all enmeshed and entangled, and I think a lot of it can really be understood through much more mundane, cynical manipulation techniques, without having to bring in overly fanciful, systems of interpretation, which themselves have been sold to us, it seems.
No, I think you had a point that it's written about first, and language
Oh yeah, right,
creates
thanks.
reality,
Yeah.
So, well, that they're authored, it just kind of like written into existence almost. Even the stories of Kenneth Arnold and Roswell, it wouldn't be unimaginable that those were just, stories, news stories, let's create this hysteria, and then it enters, the modern mind, and we have new gods, we have a new myth. And you can just see it with all the spin-off religions and creepy brainwashing stuff that goes on there. I've always wanted to visit, UFO cult just to kind of get an inside scoop of it. There was one where I lived near Mount Adams in Washington. And I don't know if you've heard of Esetti Ranch.
No.
But there's a group there that believes that I think Lemurians are, you know, some kind of classification of beings live inside the mountain, right. Like Mount Shasta. There are probably others, but yeah, and there's a group there that I think it might just be one person that channels the the beings, but it'd be a fun road trip anyway.
Right.
Just to see how far the delusion goes, you know, like how are people so duped? I mean,
well, like I say, I think that was the beginning point, was going but was seen and not seen. It goes back to childhood. So
right. The
ideas, the beliefs, the narratives that we are introduced to in childhood take such a deep hold on our psyches that the critical faculties that we think we develop later in life don't apply when those associations get activated.
Yeah. What's bizarre to me is I agree that a lot of my own interest was engineered through media, especially that movie Fire in the Sky really, mm-hmm. really kind of hit me. But, you know, I did have a UFO or what I thought was a UFO experience. I saw twice. One when I was mm-hmm. young, and then one later. Again, when I was out in the desert on psychedelics, strangely. But, you know, looking back, like when I think about the one in the desert, it you know, it happened when I was in a particular state of consciousness. You know, and that's mm-hmm. that's why I'm in this whole liminal realm with it, where I don't know what validity, if any, it has. I just have to question it and dig deeper, I guess. Because I've had personal experiences, you know, as have you, it seems.
Yeah, as have I, indeed. And it's tempting to want to recount them and revisit them.
Right.
But I think that's the basis of my skepticism, really, isn't so much that, well, those experiences weren't as real as I thought, or it was just subjective, or it was just psychedelics, or I might have been deluded, or I might have been tricked. It's what were they actually? Well, I don't want to be too utilitarian about it, but I mean, what use did they actually have? Wow. How have I ever really applied them? I wrote books about them. I created an identity out of them. But I'm not here to create an identity. I'm not here just to write books either. Certainly not books that just help me create an identity. So, on the contrary, as you know, it's actually trying to take apart that machinery.
Yeah.
So then, how did they help me to see through the, you know, the spell, it's about like the Wizard of Oz thing. I mean, most of that stuff was wizardry. It was wizard stuff.
Right.
I wouldn't have noticed the man behind the curtain, even if the curtain had been drawn. I would have just ignored, because the thing on the screen is so big and amazing.
Right.
You know, who wants to look at a little man pulling levers? But really, that's where it's funny I'm using this metaphor, because it's all very dubious in itself, yeah. The movie and but you know, whatever metaphor, if it works, I'll use it. That is where something useful can be gleaned, because it makes sense of everything gets recontextualized. Oh, wait a minute, the guy pulled his arm and the fire came out of the wizard's mouth. Maybe there's a correlation between what that little guy's doing there and what I'm seeing on the screen. So recognizing that, like these internal mechanisms that are creating these phantasmagorical reenactment scenarios around us, including UFOs and visitations and all the rest of it, that would seem to be the value in them. And there is. I mean, they are providing clues, of course. It's just that the nature of them is so spellbinding and gobsmacking that we tend not to really follow them where they're going. It's like fool's gold. We'll take the pyrite instead of seeing that, oh, if there's fool's gold here, then maybe that means there's these other minerals, and if we follow that, oh, there's the real gold. It just looks like dirt, but there it is.
Yeah,
I think that this wanting to have the clues to be really big, the indications, the signs. It's like in the, going back to the Christian thing, it's an evil generation that looks for a sign.
Right.
It's actually a way that we trick ourselves and keep us under the spell, right. I think.
Yeah, and, you know, within the UFO community, this expectation of a disclosure.
Yeah, I was thinking that recently, but just in general, it's not just, because that's in the X-Files thing, that something big's going to happen. And
yeah.
It's like, isn't it time, aren't we, can't we reach a point where we can just let go of this expectation and admit that nothing's ever going to happen? It's already happening.
Yeah.
It's like, it's always been happening, and it's just going to keep on going the way it's going, and yeah, maybe eventually, but it's not gonna be this one big event. And even if there is, waiting for it or trying to, we're never gonna predict when it happens. So what is that? It's just a displacement activity. It's just a big distraction, really. It's something to live for.
Right. Yeah.
Like I look forward to the next TV show and I watch. I look forward to X-Files like a chump. it's like that on a massive scale, isn't
it? Yeah, and I think it creates a kind of dissociation where we're never in the present. It's always this.
The next thing.
Yeah, and it's funny and humbling and kind of pathetic to think that it is just a silly little man, behind a screen. Mm. But yeah, you have to see it for what it is.
So I guess that little man is a. I mean, what I'm getting from that in terms of clues is an ancestral thing. Like, so for me, the silly little man is my father.
Sure.
And my grandfather.
Yeah, yeah.
Those internal mechanisms that were passed down to me, I mean, they're in the DNA, so they didn't belong to my father, my father's father, they're pre-human even, but whatever,
sure.
they were shaped and conditioned by those men in my past, and it's not just men, but as a man primarily. And that is, you know, who wants to really look at the ways in which they're like their father and they've been shaped by their mother? And it's not that it's dull, but it's not exciting. It's not glamorous.
No, I mean, it's interesting. You know, chain is a word that's used with DNA, a long chain of DNA, you know, that we're like shackled to the past.
Yeah.
I don't personally view it that way so much. I think that's what individuation is all about, is at least becoming aware of what, you know, those traits are that you inherited. And
yeah, it's identifying them to find out what you are besides them, which is that, back to that, the internal Christ,
the
subtle signal which isn't defined by ancestral patterns and social conditioning, which is just there, which is always there. And no future cataclysmic event is going to change that or make it, you know, bigger or smaller, because it's not influenced by anything that happens at a physical level.
Right.
So I think that's a correlation I hadn't made before. There is that being shackled to the past would be what is instilling us in this desire for this future event, because we want something to set us free from the past, and it has to be in the future, because otherwise,
yeah,
it's not going to happen. We don't see there's a way just to let go.
Yeah,
we don't recognize that subtle signal in the present, so then something big has to happen in the future.
Yeah, and I think sometimes that event can be in our past, and we just don't know it. You know,
the cataclysm.
Yeah, the event that unties us. You know, or I think it's really interesting. You researching your family history. I've kind of done a little bit of my own recently, and it's a really interesting process. I don't know what to say about it yet. I'm still kind of working through it, but yeah, just you know, it seems like. That's not really a care or concern of most people these days, if I can generalize. In fact, they'd rather forget, you know.
That's the advice that you'll get,
Yeah.
probably,
Yeah.
if you start digging into your family past, will be
Yeah.
let the past be past. Let,
Right.
why are you dwelling on the
Yeah, just
past?
enter the global village and, you know, we're all one, man. But no, I've put a lot of stock in my own history, and because I had a grandfather or great grandfather who was a Freemason and also in the Ku Klux Klan, so you know that's really interesting to me and kind of disturbing, and it's murky. I mean, that era specifically, that's my great grandfather. I know so little, and my father doesn't talk about his father or, you know, his grandfather much. It's kind of just like a subject that's just taboo almost. When I'm
Well, so that would be very compelling, I would have thought, to want to go there. Because you won't be able to forever. I mean, there's a time limit on that opportunity. I didn't. I mean, there are things, my God, I would ask my father now, as you can guess, that I never even thought to ask him. I asked him why or how he thought about his father. He talked about that very briefly, but that's about it in terms of. And same with my mother. My mother, before she died, I asked her if she had a secret. We had my last conversation was around this, how she, I thought she was keeping a secret, and she didn't seem to be aware of what it was. So I think that the best kept secrets, we actually manage to forget that we've kept them. We use amnesia to really protect them, and that was my sense with my mother. I think she'd forgotten, and I didn't know enough back then to prompt her and to lead her to the areas where they were kept. Whereas now I do have a sense of where at least her secrets were kept, if not exactly what they were. So, but yeah, it's a very rich resource one's if one's ancestors are alive. But of course, it's like a minefield. You don't want to step into it too impetuously, or without being prepared.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when his world come tumbling down. Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey spoke when his world came tumbling down. His mind. Oh, here comes the monkey. And monkey speaks his mind. Oh, here comes the monkey. And monkey speaks his mind. And this was all that monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down.
La vie dans la jungle, c'est comme un sympa. Des lèvres l'air de bois, tout pose des problèmes. Les songes sur les arbres préparent mon goût. Ils sont des armes nuisibles, des destructions massives.
soul.